Hello and welcome. Today I'm going to talk about the U.S. Constitution, its relevance and its spirit, and how many people misunderstand its original spirit and intention, and its relevance in today's America. In no country is the Constitution so respected or revered as here in the United States of America. But paradoxically, perhaps in no country is the Constitution so ignored and disregarded as it is in the United States. The U.S. Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution are displayed in the National Archives building in Washington, D.C. It's an impressive, imposing building modeled after an ancient Greek temple, and the documents are displayed in a reverential way, in the rotunda of the National Archives, which has the feel or spirit of a large cathedral or a place of worship that emphasizes the centrality, the reverential place of the U.S. Constitution in the American imagination and spirit. The U.S. Constitution has been in place or in force, at least in name, longer than the written constitution of any other country in the world. But as I'm going to explain in some detail today, this entrenched reverence for the country's basic law is misplaced, and given the problems we face today and the challenges of our time, this reverential view of the Constitution is misleading and even dangerous. A constitution is important for any country, but its usefulness and relevance are greatly limited by the character and outlook of the people who apply it and of the society's underlying customs and values. Now, I'm going to make two basic points in this broadcast. First, that a constitution is far less important than the quality, the character, the outlook, the values of the people of a society, and especially of the leaders of the society. And second, that there's a great deal of ignorance and false ideas about the real spirit of the U.S. Constitution, and that this ignorance and this reverential view of the Constitution is, in our world now, in our times today, a misleading and even dangerous thing. A constitution does not keep a society from being corrupt or crime-ridden or chaotic or from having a low educational or cultural level. A constitution is not a substitute for a good society. It doesn't make a society healthy or prosperous. It's an instrument of government. But many Americans, especially Americans who call themselves conservatives, have a reverential view of the Constitution that is divorced and not rooted in reality. Many of these people believe that the problems and ills of our society would be solved, at least in large measure, if, as they say, we would restore the constitutional republic, and, they believe, return this country to what they call its constitutional principles. But, as I'll explain, very few of those people who say that really understand just what those original constitutional principles really were. For one thing, the principles certainly were not democratic. And many of those who call for a constitutional republic have no idea about what that really would mean because they don't understand what the original Constitution was all about. As we will see, the U.S. Constitution now is so blatantly disregarded and violated that it's largely irrelevant. Regardless of how well-written or ingenious a nation's constitution may be, the society is no better than the quality and character of the people and especially the character of those who control its political and cultural life. Now, for all the reverence and attention that Americans give to the Constitution, for example, politicians, including the President of the United States, when they come into office, have to swear an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States. In spite of that, it's remarkable just how blatantly the Constitution is violated and ignored. The U.S. Constitution limits the power and authority of the federal government. Only specific, limited powers are delegated to the central government. To further clarify individual and states' rights not spelled out in the Constitution, 10 amendments, known as the Bill of Rights, were approved and came into force in 1791 after the original Constitution was approved. The 10th Amendment of the Constitution declares, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people." Now, this means that the federal government has no legal right or authority to do anything not specifically authorized by the Constitution. By any common sense reading of the Constitution, therefore, there is no legal basis for many entrenched and familiar federal government programs. These include the Social Security Program, Medicare, Medicaid, the National Interstate Highway Program, the NASA Space Program, the National Park System, Federal Aid to Education, the Federal Food Stamp Program, Federal Aid to Farmers, and much, much more. So how is it that these programs can be considered legal and constitutional? Well, the answer is that what's legal or constitutional is determined not by the letter of the U.S. Constitution, but by the politicians and, formally, by the U.S. Supreme Court. The decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court reflect the views of those in power, and over the years, the U.S. Supreme Court has simply validated as legal and constitutional the laws, programs, and policies it likes. One of the most famous Chief Justices of the U.S. Supreme Court was Charles Evans Hughes. And he once put it this way, very bluntly. He said, "We are under a constitution, but the constitution is what the judges say it is." Now, as a legal basis for its sweeping authorization for policies and programs that are not really authorized by the Constitution, the court cites the so-called General Welfare Clause of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, which gives the U.S. Congress the power to, quote, "provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States." In practice, what this means is that the Supreme Court and other courts have interpreted this clause so loosely, so elastically, that they've ignored the spirit and the original meaning and the full context of the U.S. Constitution, and in particular the 10th Amendment, and disregard the intent of the Constitution's authors. And for that reason, the court's been able to justify virtually any law, program, or policy that those in power want. In 1941, the 10th Amendment came up for review by the U.S. Supreme Court, and in a decision, the U.S. Supreme Court declared that the 10th Amendment that I quoted to be what it called a truism. That is, it sounds good, but it's really an irrelevancy with no legal force. Now, I'm going to give some examples of how the letter of the U.S. Constitution has been blatantly ignored or set aside by those in power. One of the most obvious is that the Constitution provides that the U.S. Congress shall have the power to declare war. Any common sense interpretation of this means that the United States military cannot go to war without a declaration of war, except perhaps in an immediate threat of invasion or something like that. But time and again, U.S. president and the U.S. Military has sent Americans into war overseas and in other countries with no declaration of war by the U.S. Congress. That is, without any real constitutional authorization. The last time the United States Congress actually declared war on another country was during World War II. Since then, the U.S. military has been involved, of course, in numerous wars and conflicts in many different countries. But in none of those wars has there actually been a formal declaration of war. And from time to time, congressmen, senators, representatives will point this out. But it's made almost no difference. Time and again, the U.S. president goes ahead and orders troops into battle, into war, without any constitutional authorization. In 1964, for example, the President Lyndon Johnson asked the Congress to authorize unlimited military action in Vietnam. And he did so on the basis of deceit. There was not a real debate in the U.S. Congress, and the blank check authorization given by the Congress to President Johnson was in the so-called Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Now, at the time, the U.S. Congress voted unanimously to approve this with only two dissenting votes. The only two dissenting votes were by Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon and Senator Ernest Gruening of Alaska. And Morse at the time pointed out that the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was not a declaration of war. It was an authorization to the president that was unconstitutional. And, as it later turned out, Morse was more correct than he realized, because the claims made by the president in asking for this authorization by Congress were deceitful. Now, another example of the disregard of the Constitution is Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution requires that there be no secret spending of money by the federal government. Here's the wording, quote, "No money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law, and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time." Well, that's pretty clear. It means that the president or other officials cannot spend money in secret, and that expenditures of money by the U.S. government have to be made public. Well, that's been disregarded for many years now. There are secret budgets of the National Security Agency, of the CIA, that are not made public, and that's clearly, unequivocally, a violation of Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution. But again, that's been validated or approved by the political leaders of the United States and by the Supreme Court. Other examples of how the Supreme Court has declared as illegal laws and policies that for many years were universally regarded as constitutional and lawful are these. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its famous Brown versus Board of Education decision. Citing dubious sociological studies, the Supreme Court declared racially segregated schools to be unconstitutional, even though this same court had ruled in 1896 that this policy was legal and constitutional. But even more remarkable than that, probably, is the decision by the Supreme Court in 1983, the famous Roe v. Wade decision. The Supreme Court declared all state laws against abortion to be unconstitutional, even though such laws had been in place for many years. The court justified its remarkable 1983 ruling on the basis of an implied right of privacy, which is not actually mentioned anywhere in the Constitution. In short, the Supreme Court legalized or, quote, made constitutional what plainly is contrary to the letter and the spirit of the Constitution and of long-standing custom and law in the United States. The important point here is that the U.S. Supreme Court, along with the U.S. Congress and the President, has a long record of interpreting and applying the Constitution as it wishes, in accord with the prevailing cultural and political norms, and therefore in accord with the outlook, values, and agenda of those who hold power in our society. At the Constitutional Convention of 1787 in Philadelphia, where 55 men worked out the Constitution that we have, one delegate, John Francis Mercer, put it very well. He said, "It is a great mistake to suppose that the paper we are to propose will govern the United States. It is the men whom it will bring into the government an interest in maintaining it." So what's crucial, again, and decisive in determining the laws or policies of this country and of any country, it's not its constitution, but rather the outlook, agenda, and character of the people and especially the leaders of those who hold power in society. The character and quality of the American population has changed a great deal over the years. And one example of that is to compare what passes for debates today by politicians with the Lincoln-Douglas debates during the middle of the 19th century, when Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas were candidates for Senate in Illinois. To read the transcript of the Lincoln-Douglas debates is to be impressed by the complexity and the seriousness and of the arguments that they presented and the points they made. They spoke for half an hour or up to an hour at a time, making long, involved points and arguments that required careful attention. The public who was listening to these debates had the intelligence and the patience to listen and to carefully consider these arguments. Well, that's unthinkable in today's political climate. It's hard to imagine Sarah Palin or George W. Bush or Herman Cain or many other American politicians being able even to follow the rigor and the narrative of that kind of debate. In other words, even the character or the patience level of the public has changed over the last century and a half in the United States. Dan Smoot was for many years a conservative writer and publicist, and in the foreword to a book I have, he wrote, "Through the years, I have known many members of Congress who agreed with me privately that at least 80% of everything the federal government is doing is illegal under the Constitution, which the President and all members of Congress are sworn to uphold." Well, it may not be 80%, but certainly a very substantial amount of the laws and policies and programs the federal government carries out have no constitutional authority or mandate whatsoever. Joseph Sobran, the conservative writer, once said, "The U.S. Constitution poses no serious threat to our form of government." One of the biggest mistakes that people make about the U.S. Constitution is to imagine that the Constitution is a pillar of democracy, that it's a guarantor and the foundation of a democratic society and of a democracy in the United States. This is completely inaccurate. The 55 men who worked out and debated and set up the Constitution did so in a very undemocratic way. In fact, the men who worked out the Constitution, who wrote it and agreed on it, were men who had, in general, contempt of and distrust of democracy. In fact, a good argument can be made that the Constitution that's now in place in America is unconstitutional. Now, that may sound startling or odd, but I'll explain. The Constitution that we now have, which became effective in 1781, is not the first Constitution of the United States. The first Constitution was the Articles of Confederation. Those were adopted in 1778. They became effective in 1781. In the Articles of Confederation were regarded very widely as so ineffective and so defective that the states approved the sending of delegates to Philadelphia in 1787 to revise or amend the Articles of Confederation. Now, one state, Rhode Island, was so distrustful of the motives and intentions of the delegates who met in Philadelphia in 1787 that Rhode Island refused to even send a delegation there. So only 12 of the 13 states were even represented in Philadelphia at the convention where the Constitution was worked out. These men who met in Philadelphia were remarkably intelligent. They were very serious men, but they certainly did not believe in democracy, certainly not in the way that Americans mean it today. The very first thing they agreed was that their discussions would be completely secret. There would be no public debate or open discussion about what was happening in the room there. In effect, it was a conspiracy, and it was an unauthorized or illegal conspiracy because the men who met to work out the Constitution had no authority or mandate to do what they did. In fact, they knew that the Constitution they were working out was not quite legal. That's why they agreed and wrote that the new Constitution would be effective when it was approved by specially elected conventions in 9 of the 13 states. They knew that approval was not likely by the existing state legislatures and was not likely to be approved by all 13 states. But the original Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, required that any changes in the Constitution had to have the approval of all 13 states. Two states, Rhode Island and North Carolina, flatly refused to approve the new Constitution. They declared that they stood by the existing and legally valid Articles of Confederation, which could be changed only with the approval of all 13 states. So in the view of North Carolina and Rhode Island, the other 11 states had, in effect, seceded from the original Union. Finally, North Carolina and Rhode Island were forced to accept the new Constitution upon threat of economic sanctions if they did not approve. Again, this was entirely illegal and unconstitutional under the Articles of Confederation, the original Constitution. Now, the undemocratic spirit of the new Constitution was put into writing in the Constitution by making sure that neither the President nor the Senate was to be elected by the people, certainly not directly. And they made sure that only one house of the original U.S. form of government under the Constitution, the House of Representatives was elected by the people. This was done not because they wanted democracy, but only because they felt that if there was not some form of election by the people, that there wouldn't be enough popular support to approve the new U.S. Constitution. Well, we'll take a break at this point and resume with the second half of this broadcast. Welcome back. The men who worked out the original Constitution at the convention in Philadelphia in 1787 required that the Senate of the United States was to be set not by the people, but was to be appointed by the state legislatures of each of the states. It wasn't until the early 20th century, by constitutional amendment, that that was changed and the Senate was elected directly by the people. But even more remarkable, the original Constitution arranged the selection of the chief executive, the President of the United States, in a very undemocratic way. In fact, the original Constitution required that the President was to be chosen by a so-called electoral college. The electors were not pledged to any candidate beforehand. The electors were to be chosen not by the voters, but by the states through state legislature or by convention, and the electors were to quietly on their own decide who should be president and vice president of the United States. The original Constitution, as originally was written, the U.S. Constitution required that the person who got the highest number of votes would be president, and the second highest number of votes, the person who got the second highest number of votes would be the vice president. The assumption was that all of the candidates, or whoever was selected, would be so much in agreement that they would not be adversaries, but would work together in the same spirit as the 55 men who met at the Constitutional Convention. In other words, the men at the Constitutional Convention assumed that America would be run for as long as the Constitution existed by men like themselves, who they regarded themselves as more capable, more aware, better educated than the mass of people. And they wanted to make sure that power did not come into the hands of the mass of people. They were distrustful of democracy. John Adams, the second president of the United States, said this: "Men in general, who are wholly destitute of property, and also too little acquainted with public affairs to form a right judgment, and too dependent on other men to have a will of their own." Alexander Hamilton said, "The people are turbulent and changing. They seldom judge or determine right. It is admitted that you cannot have a good executive upon a democratic plan." In the last letter that he ever wrote, Alexander Hamilton, who was the first U.S. Secretary of Treasury, warned, quote, "Our real disease is democracy." Governor Morris of Pennsylvania, who more than any other man was responsible for the style in which the Constitution was written, said, "There never was, nor ever will be, a civilized society without an aristocracy." He also said that the people never act from reason alone. Another delegate, Edmund Randolph, expressed the view that the evils under which the U.S. labors had their origin in what he called the turbulence and follies of democracy. Another delegate, George Mason, said that it would be as bad to let the people elect a president as it would be to refer a trial of colors to a blind man. The first president of the United States, George Washington, who was commander of U.S. military forces in the Revolutionary War and who presided over the Constitutional Convention, was the richest man in the United States at the time. He had enormous land holdings and owned hundreds of slaves. He feared the growing of an urban population in America. He said, "The tumultuous populace of large cities are ever to be dreaded. Their indiscriminate violence prostrates for all time all public authority." One of those most remarkable things that George Washington ever wrote was in a letter to John Jay, who was later a Supreme Court justice. Washington said this, "We have probably had too good an opinion of human nature in forming our Confederation. Experience has taught us that men will not adopt and carry into execution measures the best calculated for their own good without the intervention of a coercive power. I do not conceive we can exist long as a nation without having lodged somewhere a power which will pervade the whole Union in as energetic a manner as the authority of the states' governments over the several states." In other words, Washington was very skeptical of democracy, of the will of the mass of people, and believed in what he called a coercive power as necessary to make people do what he believed was even in their own good. Another way in which the original intention of the Constitution was subverted or changed, or at least the Bill of Rights, is in the very First Amendment, the famous Bill of Rights protection of freedom of speech. It says Congress shall pass no law to prohibit or curtail freedom of speech. But in fact, that portion of the Constitution, that first article of the Bill of Rights, has been grossly disregarded in two important ways. First, because it's been interpreted to permit speech that the men who wrote the Constitution would have considered completely intolerable. For example, the men who wrote the Constitution believed in, Hamilton, Madison, Washington, and Franklin, even Jefferson and Thomas Paine, all supported criminalizing what they called seditious libel. That is, statements about the government that were smears and reckless attacks that might undermine the authority of the government. Today, that's protected by the Constitution. On the other hand, things are now prohibited in America that the Founding Fathers would not have prohibited. One good example of that is that in the United States, it's illegal to put up a billboard advertising cigarettes. It's illegal to run an advertisement on television advertising cigarettes. Now, that's not to say that that's a good or bad thing, but the Founding Fathers never imagined that the banning cigarette advertising would be permissible under the First Amendment. The weakness of the Constitution is probably most obvious in the crisis that was the most important crisis in American history, the crisis leading up to and culminating in the Civil War. In the greatest crisis in American history, the U.S. Constitution failed completely. The Constitution had no provision for a state leaving the Federal Union. And regardless of whether you agree with the arguments made by the Southern states when they seceded, that they had a right to do so, or if one thinks that Lincoln was right in suppressing what he regarded as the rebellion, the point is that the wording and the letter of the U.S. Constitution proved to be irrelevant in that greatest crisis of American history. One of the Constitution, far from being a sacred document, contains provisions which are even imprecise or even dangerously imprecise. Perhaps a good example of that is the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. It was meant to make sure that former slaves would have the rights of citizens of the United States. But that's not what the 14th Amendment says. What it says, quoting directly, is all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Well, what this means in reality is that in the U.S., any person born here is automatically a U.S. citizen, even if the mother has come into the United States only for tourism purposes or even illegally. The result of this 14th Amendment, as it's written, has been to give rise to birth tourism. There are tourist agencies in Turkey, Taiwan, China, and Korea, which arrange routinely for pregnant women to come to the United States, stay in hotels, go to hospitals, and have children born in the United States who are then automatically U.S. citizens, so that their family has a U.S. citizen as a family member. This is not at all, of course, what the founding, what the people who made the 14th Amendment ever intended, and they certainly did not intend that people coming into the United States, giving birth to a child, would give birth to a child who would then automatically be a U.S. citizen. This underscores the importance of precision in the law, and in this case, the law was written in a way imprecisely so that it now applies in a way that those who wrote it never intended. The Electoral College provision of the Constitution was written, as I mentioned earlier, with the assumption that the men who run the United States would be so much of like mind, so similar in outlook, that they would cooperate with each other and that there would not be any serious or difficult factions or parties. In other words, the men who wrote the Constitution did not anticipate the rise of political parties. And that's why the original Electoral College provision of the Constitution said that the person getting the most votes was the president, and then the person getting the second largest number was vice president. The original Electoral College delegates were not to be pledged to anybody in advance. But very early on in the United States, the electors were pledged to one person or another beforehand. And although formally today people vote for electors and not directly for the president, they're really voting for individuals who are already pledged in advance to one candidate or another. But that's not at all what the original Constitution provided for or was the intent of those who worked out the Constitution. Today, the U.S. Constitution, far from being a weapon of freedom, has become a legal instrument for the ongoing dispossession of the original stock who made the Constitution. The outlook of the men who wrote the Constitution was anything but democratic or all-inclusive, as now is assumed to be the right way to things should be organized in the United States. For example, the Founding Fathers never imagined that American Indians would be regarded as citizens of the United States. Oftentimes I ask people, well, how long has the United States been a democracy? Everybody assumes the United States is and always has been a democracy. Well, it wasn't until the early 20th century that women had the right to vote. In other words, the majority of the population of the United States had no political power for more than a century of history of the United States. And of course, Indians in the United States were not citizens either. They were not made really citizens until the 1920s in the United States. The original founding fathers, the people who worked out the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, of course, did not regard blacks as citizens of the United States. They were slaves and property. My point is that the original Constitution was anything but a document in the spirit of the United States today, anything but a democratic document. Now, many people who talk about the Constitution and urge a return to the original Constitution imagine that up until recently, maybe up until the founding of the Federal Reserve Bank or something, that American presidents upheld the Constitution as it was originally intended. But that's not at all true. A good example of that is already with in the early 19th century when Thomas Jefferson was president of the United States. Now, Thomas Jefferson is considered perhaps the most staunch and principled defender of the U.S. Constitution. But even he, and at an early time in the history of the United States, carried out, ordered an action that, as he admitted, was not actually permitted by the Constitution. In 1803, the Emperor of France, Napoleon, wanted to sell the vast Louisiana Territory to the U.S. President Jefferson authorized the U.S. envoy in Paris to purchase this vast area for $15 million. This was the so-called Louisiana Purchase, and it greatly increased the size of the young country. It included an area that it was an area that included the present-day states of Louisiana, Arkansas, Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, and much of Montana, Colorado, and Wyoming. Now, purchasing this vast area for just $15 million was, of course, a tremendous opportunity. But there was no authority in the U.S. Constitution for the president to do such a thing. And Jefferson admitted that this was the case. Even though he was a so-called strict constructionist, a person who tried to follow the letter of the Constitution, he was concerned that there was no authorization to do this. And that's why he proposed an amendment to the Constitution giving him that authority. He wrote in a letter to a U.S. senator, quote, "The Constitution has made no provision for our holding foreign territory, still less of incorporating foreign nations into our union. The executive, that is the president, in seizing a fugitive occurrence which so much advances the good of this country, have done an act beyond the Constitution. The legislature, that is the Congress, in casting behind them metaphysical subtleties and risking themselves like faithful servants, must throw themselves on their country for doing for them unauthorized what they know they would have done for themselves had they been in a situation to do it." That is, Jefferson was saying that the objections made by people in the Congress, that what he was doing was unconstitutional, he dismissed as what he called metaphysical subtleties. But he admitted there was no authorization for the president to purchase foreign land in this way. He also wanted to set aside a very large part of the Louisiana Purchase for American Indians. Now, there was opposition to this purchase in the Congress, but he went ahead anyway. And but my point is this, that already early on, the letter of the Constitution was being violated by chief executives and by the U.S. government from a very early time. But what's important is not the letter of the Constitution in that sense. What's important is the, again, the agenda, the outlook, the spirit, the character of the people who ran the United States. In addition, the purchase of the Louisiana Territory was almost certainly illegal. Napoleon had no right to sell the territory to the United States, and Spain, which had had the territory, protested. And by today's standards, the sale would have been considered illegal or objectionable because the people who lived in most of this territory, the native Indians, were never consulted or given any compensation whatsoever. But and those people today who talk about returning to the spirit of the Constitution, I would ask how many of them would be in favor of rescinding, or how many of them would have rejected the purchase of the Louisiana territory, which was immensely beneficial to the United States because it was not strictly authorized by the Constitution. Even more than that, Alexander Hamilton and James Madison had very different views about the proper role of the government, of the federal government, but both agreed the federal government did not have the authority under the Constitution even to build canals. Of course, since then, the federal government has done much more than build canals. But again, do those people who say the Constitution should be strictly interpreted believe that it shouldn't even have the authority to build canals, much less federal roads? Now, a more important point is this. A constitution is far less important than many Americans really believe for any country. For example, Britain has gotten along well for centuries with no written constitution whatsoever. And other countries, which are very unattractive places to live, have constitutions that, at least on paper, are very good. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Its constitution is largely a copy of the U.S. and French constitutions, and it guarantees life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But this does not seem to have helped Haiti very much. Mexico's constitution, established in 1917, is also in large measure copied after the U.S. Constitution and contains a lot of the familiar guarantees of freedom that American conservatives say are very important. But Americans who call themselves conservative or libertarian often say that what they want is a society of limited government and low taxes, and they seem to think that a constitution and a government with a limited role is critically important in determining the quality of life in a society. For example, these libertarians object to a compulsory national health care program, and they say that that's unconstitutional. And they seem to think that just with limited government, characterized by low taxes and the absence of so-called socialistic programs, everything else in the society will be basically good. But is that really true? Are conservatives and libertarians who say this really being honest with themselves? Which country would conservatives rather live in? Canada, which has a relatively high tax rate, as well as various so-called socialistic programs, including a national health care system, or in Mexico, which has lower taxes and no national health care program? From a libertarian point of view, or people who believe in limited government, Mexico should be a more desirable place to live in than Canada. Or here's another example that's even more striking. In Haiti, the government interferes hardly at all in the lives of its citizens. Haiti has a great-sounding constitution, specific pledges of protection for individual rights. It has low taxes, lower taxes in Haiti than in the United States, and the government of Haiti plays a much smaller role in the lives of its people than does the U.S. government. So why isn't Haiti a more desirable place to live in than, say, Canada? On the other extreme, Denmark has a highly, quote, socialistic government. But which country is more desirable to live in, Denmark or Haiti? Well, the answer is obvious. Because what's crucial, what's critical in a society is the level of social order and culture, the character, customs, and quality of its people, not its constitution, not the extent of its government, not its tax level. Many Americans seem to believe, almost as a matter of faith, that if there is a maximum of individual freedom in society, this will somehow automatically mean that the society will have a high level of order, prosperity, education, and culture. But an understanding of history and awareness of other countries and peoples, and even common sense, should be enough to make obvious to any thinking person that this widely accepted view of the U.S. Of the U.S. Constitution is false and foolish. Well, that concludes this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. Thank you for listening. I welcome your comments and suggestions, and I hope you'll join me for the next broadcast.